Another amazing tale out of Australia now. The long quest to solve an Australian military mystery, identifying a man who for 80 years was the unknown sailor. This is a case that had bugged the Royal Australian Navy for decades, trying to put a name to a World War II crewman who was found to have initially survived a fierce nautical fight. The HMAS Sydney was involved in a battle with a German warship off the coast of Western Australia in 1941. Both boats sank, and it was thought that all of the Australian crew died. This is where the mystery begins. Months after the ocean conflict, a life raft with the remains of an unidentified HMAS Sydney crewman was found near Christmas Island. He was one of the 645 crew who died in what remains Australia's greatest naval disaster. No other bodies were recovered. But who was he? DNA expert Jeremy Austin from the University of Adelaide takes up the story. Welcome, Jeremy.
Good morning.
How and when did the case come onto your radar?
So the Royal Australian Navy contacted us in 2007. The sailor's body had been found in Christmas Island because his gravesite was actually lost after the Second World War. And the Navy had spent 5 or 6 years looking around in the cemetery on Christmas Island and eventually found the man's grave, exhumed the body. And they came to us in 2007 asking if we could help with some DNA analysis of the skeleton to see if we could help identify him.
So it had been known that he existed, or the corpse existed. It had been found. Just explain the conditions in which it was first found.
Unfortunately, once the man was buried, he was found in this life raft. There was no identification. There was no real attempt to identify him before he was buried. And he was buried in this cemetery on Christmas Island. And then, unfortunately, the Japanese took control of the island for a short period of time during the Second World War. And during that time, the site of the grave, was lost. As I said previously, the Navy went back and they talked to a lot of locals. They looked at old photographs and eventually managed to track this the actual grave down. And on exhuming the body, all they found literally was his skeleton, a few press studs from the boiler suit that he was wearing when they found him in the life raft, and he had a piece of about a 1 centimeter size piece of German shrapnel still embedded in his skull, and that was probably what had killed him.
So 645 sailors were known to be on the Australian naval vessel. Your task is to narrow it down to one identity. And how so?
Yep. So our research group here at the University of Adelaide, we've got expertise in getting DNA out of degraded skeleton remains, so whether that's humans or animals. And so what we did was we were given the lower jaw of this man. We pulled a couple of his teeth out. Ground up the roots of those teeth and extracted DNA. And then we went and sequenced a piece of DNA called mitochondrial DNA, which mitochondrial DNA you only inherit from your mother, which means siblings, so brothers and sisters, will have the same mitochondrial DNA as each other, as long as they have the same biological mother. And you'll share that with your mother and any maternal aunties and uncles, and also your maternal grandmother, etc. So you end up, there's a, quite a large group of people in your immediate maternal side of your family that you share your mitochondrial DNA with. And so the Navy had identified three sailors who they thought this man was based on age and height characteristics and dental records and various other things. So they went out, found maternal relatives, living maternal relatives of the sailor. And you can imagine that's quite a challenging process because the sailor died in 1941. And you've got to essentially try and find people alive today who are somehow related directly to the sailor's mother or his maternal grandmother. So they found these three living relatives, got DNA samples from them. They're just buccal swabs, just a little mouth swab. Sent that to us, and we tested that DNA, and unfortunately there wasn't a match to the sailor. So that was three sailors that we could exclude. The Navy then said, okay, we've got another list of, I think it was about 26 next most likely sailors. So over the next couple of years, they managed to track down maternal relatives of those 26 sailors, sent us those DNA samples, and None of those matched either. So we'd now managed to exclude 29 sailors from the 645 who were on the ship. And that took a number of years. So that was probably 2011. And then we began to realize that this was going to be much more difficult than we initially thought, because finding maternal relatives of all 645 sailors on a boat could take decades.
You thought it was going to be a couple of months when you took this on.
Yeah, well, literally, when the Navy said to us, "Hey, look, we've got three sailors who we think this guy is. All you need to do is match the mitochondrial DNA from the remains to the mitochondrial DNA from the relatives of these three sailors." Yes, we honestly thought that we'd be able to do that entire project in a couple of months, and the whole case would have been resolved back in 2007.
By 2014, you had made some progress, and this was further and deeper analysis of the DNA, right? What did you learn about more details about this person, right down to hair colour, eye colour?
Yeah, over this sort of period of time, the forensic DNA community had been developing all these alternative DNA methods to inform people about what someone may have looked like. So things like hair and eye color, what their biogeographic ancestry is. So that essentially says, where in the world do your ancestors come from? And there was a lab in or a university in the Netherlands who specialized in this hair and eye color prediction test. So in about 2011, I took a small aliquot of this DNA, the sailor's DNA, went over to the Netherlands with it, and helped the laboratory over there do this hair and eye color prediction test. And we got probably, well, at the time, what we thought was the best possible hair and eye color prediction you could ever hope for in a mostly European population, and that was red hair and blue eyes. And in a ship of 645 sailors, we wouldn't have expected there to be many more than maybe five or six men with blue eyes and red hair. And you don't need to be an expert to say, well, most people with blue eyes and red hair have Scottish or Irish ancestry as well. So that, at least initially, made us think, okay, we can narrow down the search to sailors where there's some evidence that they might have had blue eyes and red hair. Not all the sailors' enlistment records survived, or that they had Scottish and Irish ancestry. And so the Navy then started targeting relatives of sailors who met that sort of criteria. And so the testing continued for the next 4 or 5 years. And some years we might get five maternal relatives turn up, other years we might get 50. And by sort of 2018, we tested, about 200 family reference samples for 150-ish sailors. And unfortunately, we'd excluded every one of those 150 sailors as being the unknown sailor.
There was some more testing of teeth done, isotope testing of teeth. This was done in Canada, and this revealed that he most likely came from Australia's east coast. How could that be? Probably northern New South Wales or Queensland. How could that be deduced?
So everything we eat contains a different isotopic signature. So a lot of the elements in the food and the water that we consume have different ratios of heavier and lighter isotopes of those particular elements. And by measuring those isotopes in teeth or in hair or in tissue, we can sometimes say something about where an individual either grew up or where they were living immediately prior to their death. This method's been used a little bit in Europe for to try and trace the origins of unidentified human remains. I've heard of a story of this happening in the UK. So yeah, this isotope analysis suggested that the man had grown up on the east coast of Australia as opposed to the west coast, because the geology of the east coast and west coast of Australia are quite different, so they have these different isotopic signatures. And that he probably had a marine diet, because we can tell people who've eaten mostly land-based, so cattle, sheep, vegetables, versus a fish-based diet. So he probably had a sort of marine, more of a marine diet. So he's probably living on the coast.
He had a very unusual characteristic. Two teeth missing, not so much. A complete set of wisdom teeth. In a mouth crammed with fillings, all nine of them gold. Was this much of a tip?
It was a surprise to me, because in modern times you don't see that many people with gold fillings. Certainly, the Navy suspected that the man had probably come from a reasonably wealthy family, because even in the 1930s, 1940s, to be able to afford to get that amount of dental work done, and also have dental work that included gold fillings, would suggest that he'd come from a reasonably wealthy family.
All right. Another tip was the sailor's mitochondrial DNA, which had been extracted from bones and successfully sequenced. Did this mean that you didn't need to find the relatives, direct relative now?
Well, yeah, by 2018, I began to realize that this could end up being, for me and for possibly, someone who came after me, a lifelong journey trying to find a living relative of an HMAS Sydney sailor who had this mitochondrial DNA. And it was about that time that the whole genetic genealogy thing was starting to take off around the world, and I became more aware of this, that there are many, many people who will pay a reasonably small amount of money, $100 or $200. They send a saliva sample, usually off to the United States, and one of these genetic genealogy companies sequences large numbers of DNA markers. And if you pay a little bit extra, you'll also get your mitochondrial DNA sequenced. And so I realized at that point that there were potentially hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people around the world who'd already had their mitochondrial DNA sequenced, as in someone else had already done all this work for us. And if I could search those databases or find individuals who had the right mitochondrial DNA, that might help us track down who this sailor was. So, 2018, I started contacting Facebook groups for genetic genealogy groups for people with Scottish and Irish ancestry in Australia. Basically anyone who might have access to private mitochondrial DNA databases that we could ask them to say, could you go on to your database and see if you could find this particular mitochondrial DNA type?
Was there a moment, a eureka moment?
At that point, no. We got a lot of responses, but none of them direct matches. And it wasn't until 2019. So this is now 12 years after we started this research and this project, that I gave a talk at a local genealogy society. And usually in these talks, I mention the HMA Sydney sailor case because it's one of these cases where, well, we know his mitochondrial DNA. We just can't find anyone in the world alive who's got the same mitochondrial DNA as him. A lady in the audience went home that night and diligently sat down and went through all her family DNA records and found someone with exactly the same mitochondrial DNA sequence in her family tree. So she emailed me that information that night. And that was really, the eureka moment, because this was the very first person that we'd ever found anywhere in the world with the same mitochondrial DNA type as the sailor. So what I did was contacted the Navy. We then spent 4 or 5 days furiously searching birth, deaths, and marriage records to trace the family tree of this individual whose mitochondrial DNA had been sequenced all the way back in time to a lady who, surprise, surprise, was born in Scotland. So there's our link to a Scottish heritage. And then back down any number of lineages from that lady to the present day, until after a number of days of searching, he found an unbroken line of female descendants that led to Thomas Willsby Clark, who was an able seaman on board the HMAS Sydney. So, September 2019, Greg Swindon at the Navy contacted me and said, "Look, I think we've found the sailor."
When you first got this information from the lady, you couldn't tell her anything, could you?
No, because at that particular moment, I didn't know whether there was a link between her and anyone on the Sydney, and I also, was very conscious of the fact that it wasn't my position to make decisions about who the sailor was. The Navy had to do all these family searches, and then an actual naval board of identification had to sit down and look at all the evidence and make a decision. So, yeah, I had to email her and say, "Oh, thanks very much for that information. It's really quite interesting." What I really wanted to say was, This is the most exciting piece of information anyone's given me in 12 years, because I think you've just found us, the sailor, or at least a link to the sailor.
Further tests happened, the police were involved even.
The Australian Federal Police here in Australia have a National Missing Persons DNA Identification Laboratory. And it was just about that time that COVID hit, which meant our lab got closed down. The AFP labs could keep running. They did a what's called a Y chromosome DNA test. So the Y chromosome is a piece of DNA that males and only males inherit from their fathers. So in order to really sort of get the information about the identity of the sailor watertight, the AFP did a Y chromosome test on a piece of bone from the sailor, and then compared that to a male a nephew. The son of one of Thomas Clark's brothers, and they got a Y chromosome match as well. So we've now got two pieces of DNA information pointing towards Thomas Clark.
Jeremy Austin, our guest, Dr. Jeremy Austin, DNA expert at the University of Adelaide, on this extraordinary story that ran for years, that he was part of. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. So, did you get to sort of finish things off and meet surviving relatives? What happened once the identity was confirmed? And also, what did we learn about Thomas Clark?
So, yeah, in 2021, which was the 80th anniversary of the sinking of the Sydney, the Navy announced the identity of the HMAS Unknown Sailor as Thomas Clark. And then in June last year, myself, some members of Thomas's extended family, and lots of Navy personnel and dignitaries, all travelled to Geraldton in Western Australia, where Thomas's body had been reburied after the exhumation on Christmas Island, and they did a rededication ceremony. So they replaced his, unknown sailor gravestone with a gravestone that bears his name. So I got to meet Colin Clark, who is Thomas's nephew. He's the man who provided the Y chromosome DNA sample, and obviously, yeah, lots of Navy personnel, people from the AFP. Greg Swindon, who was my contact at the Navy for the sort of last 10 years. And it was a really nice way to sort of end the story in order to sort of be there when the gravestone was rededicated, and Thomas's name, finally managed to appear on that gravestone.
What more did we learn about him? He was young, right? 21.
Yeah, he was only quite young. He came from a quite a wealthy family. His father had sort of grown up in poverty, but then gone on to become a very successful grazier in Queensland. So he'd grown Thomas had grown up in the seaside suburbs in Queensland. So that there's the link to growing up in on the east coast of Australia. I think the family owned an oyster lease or something similar, so there's possibly a link to the marine diet. I've subsequently had some emails from some various members of the family. Thomas had a fiance, or he had already been married before he died, and I've had emails from descendants of his widow. So yeah, it was really really I say really quite nice way to wrap this 14-year long project up, and actually find out something other than his mitochondrial DNA sequence and that he had red hair and blue eyes, to actually find out something about him. Certainly Colin Clark, his nephew, had some very sort of vague memories of Thomas before he went away on the in the war. And it's I guess this is one of the really rewarding things about using these DNA technologies, is you make a difference to someone's life, in this case a family, who had never known really what had happened to their uncle, and their relatives all those years ago.
You must, now that you know him, in inverted commas, also at times just go there in your mind, right? The sea battle in 1941, just a reminder of how close the war came, particularly to your country, but to both of our countries.
Yeah, and I mean the one thing that this project really opened my eyes to is how many Australians and New Zealanders have missing relatives from the First and Second World War. I did a bit of digging into my family history, and I found a great granduncle who died in the First World War at the Battle of Messines in Belgium. His body's never been recovered, so his bones are lying in a field somewhere in Belgium. And one day we might, or someone else, another lab in Australia might get his remains for identification. And that would mean a lot to me, even though I didn't, until 5 or 6 years ago, I didn't actually know this great granduncle even existed. But I now have a relative that I know is lying somewhere, in a field in Belgium.
It is remarkable, but when you think about this particular event also, the worst maritime disaster ever for Australia, it was wartime, but that's a lot of lost souls. And
Yeah, it's really quite amazing to think about what happened on that particular day and how bad it must have been that all 645 sailors disappeared without a trace.
he seriously was the only one with as any indication he got away in a lifeboat.
Yep, there was never any, as far as we know, no bodies ever washed up on the Western Australian coast. No other life rafts were found. Both the ships, the Cormorant and the Sydney, were discovered on the bottom of the Indian Ocean about 10, 15 years ago. And I've seen some video of the HMAS Sydney taken by, one of these submersible camera submarines. And it's really quite chilling to see the ship at 2,500 meters down, and wondering just like how many more sailors are still, trapped inside the ship. How many of them just drifted away, or got washed away in the currents? It's really quite a poignant sort of thing to think about.
It's been a labour of love over many years, and I suppose once you start, you feel like you can't stop. Tell me a little bit more about the day job. What sort of forensic research you do at the university?
So yeah, most of our research for forensic work has been trying to develop methods to improve the identification of particularly skeletonized human remains, mostly war dead, long-term missing persons, murder victims, people whose body has been in the ground for many, many, many years. More recently, we've been trying to develop or utilize sort of these ancient DNA techniques to obtain these forensic genetic genealogy markers, so the exact same sort of DNA markers that everyone's using to find long lost relatives and find out where in the world they came from. We're trying to develop methods to do that on these missing persons remains, because many, many missing persons remains come up and appear. They end up in police stations, in morgues, and no one has any idea who they are. No family members come forward. They may have been missing for 10 years, they may have been missing for 50 years. And these genealogy DNA markers could be really, really useful for trying to narrow down who these long-term missing persons remains are.
What did you hear, not just from the family, but from others, about how much this mattered, particularly the Navy historians and the Navy brass who had been pursuing it for so long?
Yeah, I think the thing that surprised me was just how many people in the Navy, who I'd never met before until I went to Geraldton last year, had somehow been involved in this project. I met the Chief of Navy, and he had actually been on Christmas Island back in sort of 2001, 2002, trying to find the grave of the unknown sailor. Certainly, identifying, repatriating, and giving a name to all of the Australian war dead is something that's very important to the military historians and many people in the Australian Defence Forces, because these are men and women who left Australia. Mostly them, they were very, very young, and whose lives were ended, and they're now sitting in fields in Europe, in mountains in New Guinea, in parts of Africa and Asia. And it's critically important that we do our utmost best to try and find as many of these people as possible, and identify them, because there are families still alive today who still grieve the loss of these people who died 70, 80, 90 years ago.
And Jeremy, where is Sailor Thomas Clark's final resting place?
So he's now buried in the Geraldton War Cemetery. This is Geraldton's about a 4 or 5 hour drive north of Perth on the coast of Western Australia. There's an absolutely stunning memorial to the HMAS Sydney on the hill overlooking the port of Geraldton. If anyone ever gets to Australia, and particularly Western Australia, I'd strongly encourage them to visit Geraldton. and go and visit that memorial to the HMAC Sydney. It's a very sort of poignant place to sort of sit and dwell on, you know, the incredible loss of life in war. And the war cemetery is not too far away from there, and Thomas's body is now there alongside a number of other Australians who died mostly during sort of Air Force training accidents, I think, because Geraldton was a Air Force port during the Second World War.
There's some images of that memorial on our webpage, listeners, if you want to have a look. And thank you for that, Jeremy. There's one key figure in here, though. I'm curious as to her reaction, and that was the lady in Scotland. That was probably the moment where a lot of hard work met a little bit of luck, right? Who was, you know, already working on her own genealogy. And when did she get to hear what she'd been part of solving?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I couldn't tell her until the Navy had made this big announcement in November 2021. I contacted her and said, look, you know, you were the key piece of information that allowed us to join the dots between what we already knew about the sailor and finding a living family member. And, you know, she was really, I think, got quite humble about her in very important role. And I really wonder sometimes about the serendipitous nature of that particular evening. I may never have been asked to give that talk at that particular group of people. She may not have turned up, or she might have listened and not just switched off. You know, what were the chain of events that made her pay attention enough to then go home and search her family's genetic history records? And then remember to send me the email pretty much that very night. And it's people like that who can sometimes make a huge difference to the identification of all sorts of unknown human remains, not just war dead, but murder victims. Again, we've got a case in Australia recently of a mother and a daughter whose bodies were recovered. The police had absolutely no idea who they were, and at least one of the most critical pieces of evidence was someone who came forward with a photograph they'd taken in a shopping centre that had the child in a pram in the background, and that allowed the police to then make all these sort of breakthroughs. And so people being sort of diligent about providing this sort of information can make a huge difference.
Jeremy, thank you so much. Jeremy Austin, who is a DNA expert at the University of Adelaide, with this incredible story of the unidentified sailor, the unknown sailor, who now is known as Thomas Clark.